everybody, David Donaldson here with another episode of Entrepreneurial Impact. You know, this week I'm very excited for our guest, Jody Orgel-Brown. Jody is an award-winning author, such books as 12 Days of Mask Christ, Sun Still Shines, and Imperfect Polly. She's a speaker, presenter, leader, and what you're about to find out, brain tumor thriver. I don't want to call you a survivor. You are, my friend, a thriver. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. I love that. A brain tumor thriver. I might adopt that for myself.
Well, hey, you know, anything I can do to kind of help move things along a little bit, right? But as I was finding out about you and researching and reading, that's really what jumped out at me. Like this whole no excuses, no holds barred, life happens. Let me grab it by the horns and continue my journey. And that's what I got in a very quick understanding of what makes you tick.
And you're exactly right. What I have learned very intimately in the last 15 years since all of this has started is there are some things that you can experience and go back to normal life. There are other things that you experience and it is the end of one life. And it is the beginning of a new life. And all you can do is control the things that you can control. You have to let go of what was so that you can accept what is and what can be. And it's not an easy journey, but it is a journey that when you are willing to take it, it can take you to new heights and help you thrive through your struggles.
Right. I mean, it's an awareness, right? We all have things. Some things are more traumatic than others. It's just the unfair nature of life. But it's the awareness that comes along of recognizing who you are now, not who you were then, right? That defines what the rest is going to look like for you.
Absolutely. And I think the thing about that that was hard for me in the beginning was my first life, I was a get her done girl. I was a conquer the world, dare I say, unstoppable. I wasn't afraid of things. I was in student government. I was a cheerleader. I was a valedictorian. Like I did all the things and I thrived on that and I loved that. And I couldn't think of anything that would scare me. In fact, my big thing when I was a kid was, yeah, anything the boys can do, I can do just as well. Because I truly felt that way. And so to all of a sudden have a total change of life where I went from being on the giving and the contributing and the winning side of life to being on the receiving side of life and the one in the bed and the one that people were coming and bringing meals to, that was a shock to my system. And it was also a shock to my soul, my spirit, my brain. Like, how do I handle this? Am I still the get her done girl? Do I still have those things within me when I can no longer do all of the things that defined me my whole life? That was a really, really big mental switch that had to happen in order to be able to get to the point of being a thriver.
You know, you use the word define who we are. I think it's a dangerous word, right? Because we become complacent when we think we know, or we've come to grips with who we are. And then life happens and yeah. You're not that person anymore.
And yet I'm also not just a brain tumor survivor or thriver. That was one of the things that scared me and scared my husband. Like he married a conquer the world person. He's like, I do not want you to be defined as the brain tumor girl. That is not who you are. And yet for 15 years, it is not just something I did experience, it is something I do experience. I still have a portion of the tumor that is there. I still have ongoing symptoms, issues, side effects, complications. I just had surgery a few months ago and I've got another one coming up in a few months. It is an ongoing process. And so what I have figured out is I cannot let any situation define me, or any trait or any part of my personality define who I am. I can allow them to refine me, to make me better, to help me be more compassionate, to help me see through the eyes of what other people go through, but I cannot let it define me. And that I had to let go of that. That's one of the many, many, many things that I've had to let go of, is defining myself by what I do. Because I used to feel like my value came from what I could do. And I cannot do all of the things that I could. But now I realize that has not in any way decreased the value that I have or what I have to offer the world.
Let me ask you, you said a couple of times now that you were driven and you're a driver and you were a get it done. Where does that come from? What experiences did you have back then that said, hey, this is who I think I am?
You know, there's the whole controversy of nurture versus nature. And I definitely think there was both aspects of it. But I really think for me, nature, it is who I was from the very beginning. I believe I was born this way. That is part of my personality. When I graduated from preschool, I spoke at my preschool graduation. You know, is that a thing? That's who I was. It came naturally. I liked to be in front of people. I liked to influence people. I liked to help people. When I was in first grade, the teacher would say, okay, I've got to go run down to the office. I'm leaving Jody in charge of the classroom. And I couldn't have asked for anything better than to be left in charge of the classroom, because that was where I felt comfortable. I think I was a leader and a conquer the world person from the beginning. And then my parents reinforced that. You can do whatever you want to do. You can be whoever you want to be. And they allowed me the opportunity to try those things and to try and occasionally fail in some of those things and then try something else. So I could find the things that really drove me, whether that was, you know, your local neighborhood athletic groups that you were a part of, or something totally different. Like, I ran for student government in elementary school. I started doing those things very early on. So I really do believe I was born with this, and then my parents allowed it to grow, develop, and thrive.
When you have that nurturing aspect, or the parental ability to say, hey, go figure it out, really does set you up. And I look back and I think to my parents too, who let me fail forward quite often without mocking me too much along the way, as they foresaw the challenges or mistakes I was about to make, but they let me make them anyways.
Yes. And that's a very important thing. And I was always one, I didn't need big punishments to be corrected. I needed a few words from my dad who said, Jody, you know, that are you living up to your potential when you do that? Is that kind of behavior in line with who you are and what you believe? And that's all it took for me. that was it. And I was like, okay, I'm getting back on track. And so those failures, those mistakes helped me very quickly define what lane I wanted to be in and who I wanted to become and what kind of person I wanted to be.
So going from there, and I do want to pause for a minute, because as we were talking pre-show, while I like to think I'm a nationally syndicated audience, I do understand the majority of my listeners are local to the Virginia's region. And I wanted you to give a quick shout out to your family and all your friends here in Warrington and your high school, which is?
Fauquier High School.
Fauquier High School.
Which, as you know, David, is... Everyone in the Virginia area and Maryland and DC area knows Fauquier, but you go outside of that area, no one knows Fauquier. And it has become one of my favorite comedic moments in some of my speeches when I tell people where I grew up and that I got to be a Fauquier High School cheerleader and I went to Fauquier Hospital and Fauquier Library. And they think it's hilarious. And then I have to go back and explain, no, there's a reason it's called this, and it was named after, and I go into a little bit of the history. But that, Virginia is my home. That is where I grew up. That is where I lived from you know, ages 4 to 17. And so really the formative years of my life were spent running around the woods in my backyard, playing in the creeks and in the ponds and in the trees. And if I could go back to that. I've tried to recreate it, but it's very hard to do when you live in the deserts of Utah, but I am doing my darndest.
So from there, right, and we obviously have to talk about the challenges that changed you, right? We don't talk about defining you, but there's a challenging and changing element that happens in your life. When you were going through this, or you were first diagnosed, did doubt creep into your mind at that point? Did you lose focus?
I would say not in the very beginning, because of the way that I believed, the things I believed about myself, my personal beliefs, my faith beliefs. I honestly believed, okay, this is a challenge. This is a challenge I have to get through, and I'm going to be better after it. When things started to get to a level of hard I had never experienced, that's when I started doubting not just myself, but everything. Whether or not I was going to survive, whether or not my belief in God was what it should be. Can I really do this? And I had an appointment at a hospital. Interestingly enough, I worked at the hospital for 10 years. And so I had very good relationships with a lot of the people that were there. And when I went into the radiation oncology department and I met with one of my dearest friends at the hospital, and he had seen my diagnosis, which was a brain tumor between the end of my ear canal and wrapping around my brainstem. And I walked in thinking my friend Paul is going to encourage me and he's going to tell me I can do this. And it was totally the opposite. He said, Jody, you have to prepare yourself. This is going to be harder than you realize. This is going to be the biggest challenge you face. And I said, but Paul, you know me. And he shook his head and said, yeah, I do. But I also know what you don't know. And I left that appointment and I called my dad and I told him that story. And he's like, yeah, but Joe, you're different than everyone else. I said, no, Dad. Paul knows me. He knows exactly who I am. And yet he is telling me that I need to prepare myself and this is going to be the battle of my life. And that was a wake-up call in that moment where I realized maybe the conquer the world girl can't conquer everything. And I did start to doubt and have questions and wonder what kind of challenge, what kind of obstacles are going to be in my way. Because up until then, everything had been more or less an obstacle. And I'm really good at jumping over obstacles. I'm really good at finding ways to navigate around them. But I started to realize this might not be one I can just navigate around. There's that poem from when you're a kid, you know, we're going on a bear hunt. And sometimes the only way to do it is to go through it. And that notion hit me after that conversation. And I did start to wonder, what is going through it going to look like? And am I going to make it to the other side?
You know, I think you touch on and you look at saying, and I do this, right? I think when we're friends with people, we rally to them, right? And whether they're a self-driven, motivated person or not, we're immediate is like, you got this. And you think that the coach, the energy, the rah-rah is where we need to go from a support metric. But to kind of hear Paul's cold truth moment to you, because he knew you so well and knew, I think differently there, that he knew what you were up against, right? To prepare you and not just prompt you up, which maybe set your vision correctly to saying, yes, you have the strength to persevere, but at the same time, recognizing that this isn't the flu.
Yes. And the interesting thing is, you know, I've talked about what my personality is, but Paul's was very much the same way, which was why we were just best buddies. I describe Paul as a person who lives his life on a trampoline. Like, he is just bouncing and happy. And even in the job that he did, which was so serious and life-changing and life-saving for so many people, he still lives his life with this energy and this enthusiasm and with this encouragement. And because that's what I expected in going to him, it made the conversation that much more serious, because he didn't just know me, but I knew him. And this was out of character for both of us to have this kind of conversation. Wow. But it did start the trajectory of changing my mindset, of saying, what do I need to do? How can I prepare? And now, 15 years later, I know far more than I did then. And now I would say it's a lot of it became about metacognition, thinking about your thinking, thinking about what thoughts you allow into your mind, thinking about the information that you put in, but also the things that you dismiss. Because not everything that you hear is fact. Some of it is not, and you just need to, you know, have it come in and then immediately dismiss it back out. And so I really had to start doing more thinking about my thinking and realizing maybe this isn't going to be like the other challenges in my life. Maybe I have to take this to a new level and prepare myself in ways that I haven't had to do before, because life came to me fairly easily. And I was able to conquer without the kind of effort that many people require.
I don't imagine that the conversation instantly changed your perspective on the whole thing. What did that evaluation process look like for you to start to say, okay, I had this turning point in my life, right? This pain is going to have some sort of purpose for what I'm going to become, or change who I was?
I don't think I thought that at that point in time. There were so many difficult conversations with doctors, with neurosurgeons, as well as with trusted friends, that it was over, and it was a short period of time because we did not have a lot of time to deal with the diagnosis before we had to jump into action and take care of it. But some of the conversations were so blunt that at the time I was frustrated with the lack of bedside manner of some of the doctors. And yet now I realize that's probably the wake-up call that I needed to be able to start dealing with what was really coming. I had a doctor, a neurosurgeon, who literally looked at me and said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Brown, but if it were me, I wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole." Excuse me? Did you just say that? Like, what does that mean? I have four little kids at home, ages 2 to 10. And he essentially just wrote me off and said, "There's nothing that we can do for you." That is one of those kinds of things that ended up being, in my mind, a scene from a movie, where my husband and I walked out of that appointment into this busy hallway in the hospital, and I just collapsed into his arms because he gave us absolutely no answers and no hope. Now I realize that was good, because he was not the right person. And if he had tried to operate on me, I would not be here today. What it took, however, was realizing that he didn't have the right expertise, and I simply needed to keep looking, keep persevering, even in the process of trying to find the people who could help me. But I didn't have that perspective at the time. The perspective I had at the time was, he just gave me a death sentence. He just told me there was nothing that he could do. how do I walk into the house with my four little kids and try to carry on and be a normal person? So the process of finding purpose from the pain came in a much longer, over a much longer period of time. It didn't happen in an instant. When it did finally happen, and the bridging the gap between those two scenarios is, we had, as happens frequently, bad news spreads quickly, faster than a fire, yeah. Right? So once news got out that Jody had a brain tumor, all of a sudden we were flooded and inundated with help, which was beautiful, with prayers, with meals, with offers for assistance. And someone came up to my husband at work and said, you know, you don't have to do this, but I heard about your wife's condition. And one of our best friends is a neurosurgeon at the Huntsman Cancer Center. And you don't have to if you don't want to, but I called him and I just asked if he would be willing to see your wife. And he said, if you want to, he will see her during his lunch hour on Friday. This was a Wednesday. And so my husband said, yeah, we'll take it. Now, we were desperate. We were looking for answers. We'd already been to a whole entire healthcare system had already written us off and said, we can't help you by this point in time. And so we went into the office on Friday. And what I found out on Friday when we went to office was that neurosurgeon had a 4 to 6 month wait to get into an appointment. But because the right person stepped in and advocated on our behalf, I was in his office in 2 days. And as he pulled up the MRI scans on his computer, total silence, not talking, not making guesses at what was going on. He just very quietly scanned through all of the different images. And then he nodded his head and he turned to me and he said, I think I can do this. And that was the most positive answer that we had had in 25 doctors. And so he was the one who ended up operating on me and saving my life. The process of saving my life didn't go quite as we anticipated. We had planned for one brain surgery and 5 days in the hospital. I ended up having 3 brain surgeries, 35 days in neurocritical care, a cerebral spinal fluid leak, an infection in my brain, a deadly condition called pneumocephalus. I lost the hearing in my right ear. The right side of my face was paralyzed. It was one of those, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. But at the end of
that— Not everything.
Yeah. Very, very true, not everything. And that was what we just kept being grateful for and you know, thanking God and feeling gratitude for, was that not everything. We were close, but not everything. And it really became, that was when I realized how important my mindset was and the thoughts that I allowed to my mind. If I allowed myself to go to the places of everything is going wrong, that's when things got harder and got worse and the pain, it was more intense. When I started keeping a mental tab of, you know, the gratitude moments, the things that I was thankful for, the kid Tyson, the nicest kid in the world who came in to draw my blood at 4 a.m. every day, but who had the gentlest touch that his needle pokes never even hurt. Or Eric, who brought in my food, who became my friend because I saw him day in and day out for over a month. When I started seeing the positive things and the things that I could be grateful for, it helped me to have hope and to keep going. So that was the bridge, right? That gapped from being inoperable to, at the end of this 5 weeks, it occurred to me while I was still in the hospital, like, I'm actually going to live. I'm going to make it out of this hospital room. And that was when I had a moment where I started to find purpose in the pain. And I remember having just a silent conversation in my mind with God and saying, I think I'm going to live. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this second part of my life, but whatever it is that you want me to do, I promise I will try to do it. And I didn't know what that meant. I had no clue of what that meant. But from that point forward, I just decided I am one of the few who has the opportunity to have a second chance, and I will do whatever I can to be worthy of it. And now I think I shouldn't even think that way, because even being worthy of it comes with a heavy burden. When I have a down day, am I acting worthy of my second chance at life? Now what I have realized is I was always worthy of it. I always had value, whether I was the conquer the world, do, go, 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 or whether I was the patient in the bed who was having a sponge bath and being taken care of. I always had that within me. It just took some time for that part of my personality to wrap around that there is purpose to the pain, and you can use it to move forward and to help others move forward and progress as well.
Wow. I think that's what a lot of people struggle with processing sometimes. They see, I'm not gonna call it a finished product, but they see who you are now, and then they can be amazed to it. And I've heard people say things like, you know, I didn't have a choice, right? But the truth is
you do have a choice.
Yes. But that in itself is an entire battle of willpower.
And I saw people whose diagnosis was not as serious as mine who did not make it out of the hospital because they did make a choice, and their choice was, what's the point in fighting anymore? And to me, that is heartbreaking. But I am also feeling very grateful and fortunate that I had a lot to live for. And I realized my youngest was 2 years old when I was going through this. And I thought, oh my gosh, if I don't survive this, my son won't even remember his mom. Holy moly. I mean, that was a heavy, heavy moment, but also motivating in one of the most powerful ways you can imagine. Because when I was literally on the verge of death and I believed I was saying goodbye to my mortal life, it was his, I don't share this very often. It was his face that popped into my mind. And I do believe that that was to give me the strength to help me realize I do have some control in this situation, and it is my choice. I can give up now and it would be so much easier. Or I can keep fighting and it will continue to be hard, but the fight will be worth it.
Yeah, the fight is definitely worth it. Let's just kind of breathe through that for a moment, because that's some deep stuff. And I really want to thank you for kind of going there with us, right? Because it sets the table and it gives context to what you've become or becoming, or however we want to kind of package that up, of this unchanging, unfinished story for you, right? Recognizing that there is more out for me, and I have to continuously strive to become, and in your own mind's eye, uplift or uphold the chance that you have. That's powerful stuff, right? And I'm sure, and I know that your kids see that too.
They do. And they are also my biggest advocates, and they're my right-hand helpers. They're there for anything that I need. And I think what we have come to realize is, what if your struggle isn't the end of your story, but it's the beginning of your story?
Yeah.
It's where you have the chance to take that hero's journey and decide, which direction am I going to go? And am I going to come out and be the protagonist, the conqueror, or am I going to be the side character that gives up and leaves the story behind, and it becomes someone else's story to carry on? And I decided I was not going to let that happen. And so I very quickly realized after I got out of the hospital that I was not the whole, well, healthy person I thought I would be when I got out of the hospital. I weighed 89 pounds. I had no strength. I had been bedridden for over a month where I couldn't even hardly get out of bed. My muscles had atrophied. I couldn't walk to the park. I couldn't walk through the grocery store without either sitting in one of the little chairs or like holding on to the cart for dear life. And I knew I needed to have a purpose to keep myself going. And of course, my family is always a purpose and primary purpose, but I couldn't do anything for my family at that point in time. I was not well enough. And so I had to start setting little goals as though I was working with a coach almost, someone coaching me saying, okay, let's try to have you get to this point. And then once you've hit this, then you got to get here and then you got to get here, and moving you forward, helping you progress by hitting little goals at a time. I started giving myself little goals because I realized everyone in the world was giving me the excuse to do nothing, to stay home, take care of yourself, rest, recover. That was not good for my mental health. I needed to have a reason why I was still here. And so having these little goals that I was working for gave me something to aim toward. And I set a day where I was going to go back to work. I had an 8-month leave of absence where they held my job. I don't even know why to this day, but they held my job. And so I looked at the calendar and I thought, okay, come September when the kids go back to school, I'm going back to work. And I circled a day on the calendar. And I thought, whatever it's going to take, I am going to get there. And so I started doing little things, trying to walk up to the park and do one lap around the park at first, introducing foods and trying to start to eat again and trying to put on a little weight and just tiny, tiny steps. But I knew I had to have something that I was working toward. And it ended up being a great opportunity for me because I went back to work on that day that I had circled on the calendar. And my job at the time, I was a professional nonprofit executive. I raised money for charities and I helped give money to organizations to help other people's lives. So talk about a complete switch. You know, I'd been on the giving end my whole life and then I went to the receiving end and I thought, I have got to get back to the giving side of life. And when I was able to go and do that, I started to again feel like, okay, there is purpose in this. I can still make a difference. And in sharing my own story of going from one side to the other, that was very impactful for people. And they realized they were fortunate to be on the giving side. And it was easier to help them than give for the people who are on the receiving side. And that was what started this real mindset change of, I've got to find a way to become better because of this. I cannot let it drag me down. I have to find a way to get better.